Good evening and welcome to Every Woman's Space. This edition of Every Woman's Space presents the Woman's Legal Clinic. The Woman's Legal Clinic is a monthly feature of Every Woman's Space. And tonight, on the Woman's Legal Clinic, Betty Levinson, an attorney in private practice and one of the regular producers of the Woman's Legal Clinic, discusses the issue of abortion with Rhonda Copeland of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Rhonda Copeland is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has had a long and continuous involvement with the issue of abortion, first in the fight to legalize abortion, and then in the many court cases to prevent implementation of the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal reimbursement for abortion procedures. Most recently, Rhonda Copeland was the attorney who argued the case McRae versus Harris before the Supreme Court of the United States to try to prevent legalization of the Hyde Amendment. 10 years ago, it was the women's movement that raised the abortion issue to national prominence, and with the slogan, "A woman's right to choose," began the drive for legalization of the abortion procedure. That legalization took place with the Supreme Court decision of 1973. But since that time, there have been continuous assaults on a woman's right to choose. In addition, the issue of abortion has been raised to a major political issue and has become the rallying cry of a number of diverse right-wing groups who now call for the passage of a human life amendment to the United States Constitution and link the abortion issue with other issues of fundamental importance to the future of American society. Today, we will be discussing all those things, the abortion issue, its history and present status, its link to the religious issue, the possibility of a human life amendment, the new Family Protection Act, and perhaps most important, its broad political implications. The format of the program will be as follows. First, Rhonda Copeland and Betty Levinson will be discussing the abortion issue. Then we will take a musical break and we will come back for listener phone calls. The number to call at that time will be area code 212-279-3400. That's area code 212-279-3400. Now we're ready to begin, and the first voice you will hear will be that of Betty Levinson.
Good evening. Early on in our discussions about women's right to choose, there were many people who felt that the right to life groups, as they gathered strength and became more and more vocal, were single issue individuals who had decided to narrow and attack women's right to control their bodies. And early on, it became very clear to those who were litigating and were affected by the previous lack of freedom which women had in controlling their bodies, that the right to abortion and the right to choose was much more than that. And there was an effort, and has been a continuing effort over the last 10 years and more, to put the right to abortion, the right to choose, into its context, and to analyze and consider what kind of constituency, who is it, and where are they getting their money, as to these groups who have been eroding and have had remarkable, I am sorry to say, success in eroding these women's rights. So that tonight, as Eileen has indicated, we're going to be giving a brief background of the McRae case with which Rhonda was, I was going to say involved, which she's lived to the exception of everything else in her life for a number of years now, to tell you what happened in McRae, and then to bring the theme of the state's interruption, termination of our women's rights as to the question of controlling our bodies into the context of the current political arena. All of us have watched the television. We've seen these very handsome, silver-haired, gray men surround Ronald Reagan. They wear very fancy suits. They've got lots of money. And most of us haven't seen them before. Well, we can tell you tonight that we're going to be hearing from them, and we're going to be learning more about them, and that they have a great deal of potential deadening, horrible effect over our lives. And we want to put it in this political and social context to show that there's really not very much question that the people who started out some time ago attacking our right to choose have now come to power, and they see their rights and their power in a very broad context. And this considers not only the rights of women, but the rights of other groups and other individuals. And we will show you a little bit later on how through some legislation which is given the kind of benign name, the Family Protection Act, how the stage has already been set, and the costumes and the scenery is all in readiness, and how there is a very bad show about to come down on all of us. So let's go back, Rhonda, if we may, to basically what McRae was about, and then we'll bring us up to the current time.
Okay, when you started, Betty, and you said 10 years ago, you know, they put themselves forward as a single issue, I thought to myself, 10 years ago, we didn't take them seriously. And that's something that just to think about. McRae is the case which came out of Brooklyn, which challenged the federal cutbacks on Medicaid funding for abortion, which at that time allowed abortion funding only if a woman's life was endangered or in cases of rape or incest, if reported to proper law agencies or law enforcement agencies or public health service within 60 days. And at one point there was a sort of severe and long-lasting physical health damage exception, which was cut out later on. The Supreme Court, McRae really is an example of political power exercised both upon the legislatures and upon the court. It doesn't necessarily represent popular power, but it does represent clout. And the clout was that every year when the HEW budget came up, there would be a standoff in Congress. 1 year it lasted for 5 months before they could decide on how much abortions to fund under Medicaid or how few. Last June, the Supreme Court decided the case, and they, too, capitulated to the political clout. They said that it was all right for Congress to cut off Medicaid funding for abortion. They said they wrote a decision which virtually suggests that even if all funding were cut off, regardless of a woman's life, that it might not make any constitutional difference. But they made clear that the rape and incest exception, which is in the law, didn't make any constitutional difference. And they basically said that when it comes to funding, when you're exercising rights to privacy, when it comes to funding, the state has no obligation. And they really undid in the most total fashion the whole development of constitutional protection of the poor that began in the late 60s. They basically said that the problem here is not a problem of the state owing you something and having to deal with you fairly, but the problem, poverty is the fault of the poor. Well, in 1970, 8 members of the court said, welfare benefits are not mere charity. They're something that the system needs to run on. So that went out the window. Well, also what went out the window was the notion that poor people have constitutional rights. So long as a poor person is dependent on some kind of benefit in order to exercise their constitutional rights, they don't have them. It's like two different constitutions. That is really what McRae said, and I think one of the most telling lines, which has nothing to do with proper legal or constitutional theory, is close to the end, where they say that that issues of such emotional division in our democratic society, I can't say this except cynically, I'm sorry, should be left to the legislature and are not the province of the court. Well, it turns the Constitution on its head. The notion of the court is that the court stands there to guard fundamental constitutional rights against what will necessarily be the attack by majoritarian legislatures. That's been the history of the First Amendment. Just as with McRae, the real defense by the courts of First Amendment liberties is a rare occurrence in American history, although we tout ourselves as being the, you know, the bulwark of democratic rights. In fact, it is in rare times when there are strong movements that those rights are really recognized. Similarly with abortion and the poor, and increasingly with abortion for everyone. So basically what the court did is say, we're really not going to stand up to this attack on us. I mean, the Medicaid attack is an attack on Roe v. Wade as well as an attack on the poor. And they found, and I think it comes out of a combination of a very cowardly court, a combination of an increasingly right-oriented court, right by what I don't mean by rights, things that people can exercise despite the state, I mean reactionary-oriented court and punitive in attitude toward the poor, that the two things combined, the political hotness of the abortion issue and the anti-poor attitude that has been increasing in this court, to produce the decision in McRae. And I think that that's a lesson, because that kind of coalition is also, I think, what is reflected in a vast amount of the anti-abortion movement. I think one has to separate. I mean, I always feel like one has to say there are people in the anti-abortion movement who are single issue to a certain extent. Single issue, I mean, abortion, family, it becomes bigger than abortion, but who are not right-wingers in the sense of the new right, and who don't want to go, you know, destroy every bit of survival that the poor have. Are some who care, but I think that that's increasingly a powerless aspect in terms of what's happening politically in terms of public policy. Yeah,
Rhonda, without indulging in any breastfeeding as to fault, when one looks back and compares the crest of the women's movement around the time that the original right to choose cases came down, and the kind of cynicism and conservatism that you correctly describe in the McRae court, what kind of difference can we say there is in the fact that not only were they conservative and all the rest, but that they knew that they could get away with it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's enormous. I think one has to say, in a way, Roe v. Wade is the only right decision constitutionally. It's the only decision that everyone in this country, you know, should be able to live with, can do what they want to around abortion with, and it is the only, I mean, it is, in a sense, it was in a sense way too far after its time, although some people criticize it for coming too soon because we all stopped politicizing. But there's no question that in 1973, one was seeing the height of the women's movement, that the women's movement and and women coming together around abortion, which was the first thing that women came together around, and that energy and that drive and that militancy and the public issue that we made over something that we'd hidden in the closets for years, I think had an enormous impact on winning Roe v. Wade when we did. Now, I mean, the tables are turned. I think too long thought that the court would stand by a fundamental right. Didn't take the right to life movement seriously enough when it started. Didn't see very significant developments along the way, like in 1975 when the Roman Catholic Church promulgated a pastoral plan which is intended to turn every parish into a pro-life action committee to create this single issue kind of politics. We didn't understand what it meant in terms of power. Then in the last 18 months, what was basically a movement built by the Roman Catholic Church, and that was all also litigated in McRae, and the Supreme Court said, we don't want to hear about separation of church and state here. We're just going to pretend you really haven't said anything about it. But at any rate, that was all litigated, and it was all developed and found by the district court on the basis of all the facts we put before it, that it was the Roman Catholic Church that created the Right to Life movement. Subsequent to our completion of McRae, and we have to recognize only 18 months ago, the new right forces came together and the moral majority came together, and that the combination of those two forces is an extraordinary piece of political business. But that's where the appearance of power is today, and what that has to say to all of us is the only way we're going to win this back and save it to the extent we have it is to become the power that we were in 1973. Really, I mean, we have very little choice and very little time about that.
Yeah, just as an important footnote, the judge who wrote the lower court decision in McRae, a very lengthy, detailed work of love, I think, died several months ago.
No, he actually died two weeks ago, and he was buried on the anniversary of his decision last year on January 15th in McRae.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. Yeah, it was very sad and very kind of touching and ironic that, you know, that somehow that season should be all connected with that. But I mean, one should say something about Judge Dooling, because he gave an extraordinary amount of himself, I think, to hearing a case which the Supreme Court had previously three times said, we're reversing this case. And he let us make a record, and he mulled over those facts, both about the health impact on poor women of denying abortion funding, and also all of the issues around religious liberty, the right to conscience in terms of making the decision on abortion, and also the separation of church and state. He dealt with all of those things, I think he showed the kind of courage that really enforcing a constitution means, unfortunately, one doesn't have.
Yeah, we should also comment that,
which is something we have to realize when we talk about all these issues, that the Supreme Court is not a bulwark of advancing individual rights today. It is being turned back by the political pressures.
Well, the question of individual conscience is particularly telling, given the fact, number one, that Judge Dooling was himself a Roman Catholic, and number two, that the place of individual conscience is now being supplanted by a universalized, rather than fundamentalist conception of dictating morality to others.
Well, Betty, can I just say one thing about that? Because I think that this is a respect in which Dooling represents something I think very significant, and that is that a lot of people say, oh, he was a devout Roman Catholic, and despite that, he could understand the role of conscience and rule for us. In fact, I think that his ability to comprehend the enormity of the abortion decision came out of his very Catholicism, and that is something that we have to realize about people out there, that people with very deep, you know, religious feelings or conscientious feelings about the abortion question one way or the other can come to the position that you can't impose a rule of law on that kind of decision out of something that, you know, might lead them never to deal with it themselves. But that was, I mean, it's a sort of, his Catholicism is sort of trivialized some way, and it was interesting that I really think the decision came out of that real sense of, you know, the state can't mess around in things which are really important.
Well, people who are really pious, one hopes, are really tolerant in the historically religious sense of the word. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened too often. But it is unfortunate that we don't have him to hear us
on the next
anymore.
Round. Right.
So, Rhonda, let's bring us up to date in terms of the political and legal aftermath. Why don't we deal with the legal aftermath first in terms of what kind of reaction we're getting around the country in the states and then on the federal level?
Well, I think McRae signaled that the Supreme Court wasn't going to stand up very well on abortion questions. And I think that there's seriously now one case in the court. We're waiting for a decision on it. And it's a tremendous danger. And that is, and comes out of Utah, and it involves a statute which requires parental notification in all cases involving minors. And I think that under prior decisions of the court, there is a basis for saying that a majority of the court should declare the statute unconstitutional. I think that given the stepped-up attack on Roe v. Wade, that one cannot call that case. I mean, you cannot be sure that just as in McRae, the court failed to follow what the outlines, what the precedents of the law should have led it to, and what the spirit of its decision should have led it to, it didn't. Similarly, I think with parental notification, they could potentially approve the statute. Another thing, because I think it's important that this be relevant to our New York audience, and that is that in the New York State Legislature this winter and spring, there are three major issues people are concerned about. One is some kind of parental consent or parental notification bill, and obviously if the Supreme Court gives a green light, that's going to be a much harder battle in Albany. The other one is Medicaid. We are one of nine states, including and also the District of Columbia, which is still voluntarily funding all medically necessary abortions for poor women. There are 20% of Medicaid abortions are done for New York women, so that we have a responsibility in this state to save abortion funding for 20% of the Medicaid population of the country, which is a huge responsibility and something we will really have to focus on quite quickly as we move towards March and the budget fights. The other issue that exists in the New York State Legislature, and last year people may remember it was of such concern that the leadership allowed a parental consent bill to come out on the floor rather than have this come out, and the parental consent bill was defeated, but this that I'm talking about, and I will get to, is the Constitutional Convention resolution. I think we should talk about the efforts to amend the Constitution, and they're happening both in Congress on a federal level and in the states, and also there is now a new Helms bill which is trying to avoid the necessity of a constitutional amendment and basically try to criminalize abortion and keep the federal courts out of it without an amendment, because they don't have right now the votes for an amendment, but they do potentially have the votes for this effort. The efforts to get a constitutional amendment, in Congress they have to have a two-thirds vote in both houses, and I think that one will probably see hearings begin fairly quickly. The estimates that I've heard from Washington people are that, you know, that there are maybe 46 clear votes for an amendment in the Senate. For the Helms bill, which is a simple majority piece of legislation, they only need 51. So it gives you a sense of how close you are to something which could be quite devastating. And still, 46 is only the number of certain votes. There are others that that one can't foresee at this point.
Well, I would say that there are all kinds of issues that are susceptible to this decision to anti-federalize the conduct of our lives.
Right.
And it reminds one very much of the states' rights kind of stuff that went on around racial segregation and so forth in the 50s. And what happens is that if abortion becomes within the ambit of the individual state to decide whether or not it's criminal, what the federal courts do, of course, is say, we want nothing to do with it, and you individual states do mm-hmm. whatever you want. And they're also going to be doing that in other areas, which we'll talk about.
Betty, they've already done that around Medicaid. There's now no required federal minimum coverage. A state can cut off all funding under the new Hyde Amendment. They are trying to do that. They have two approaches on the question of a constitutional amendment. One is, in fact, to turn the power back to the states, which is not attractive to the right-to-lifers. They do not like this because it means there will be some states where there will be abortions, but which is terrible from our perspective because it means that in most states there will be no abortions. The other thing that's happening in terms of trying to get a constitutional amendment, and I started talking about New York, is a constitutional convention resolution. That is the alternative way of of amending the Constitution, and they need 34 states to call a convention. 19 have already approved it. They have several. They have a number of states targeted this year. If New York ever went for the resolution, we would we'd see a convention, because it would have such a domino effect, I think, not to use that old expression. It's serious. It's serious. The leadership was worried about it last year in Albany, and it must be fought. And the thing to say about the convention is that not only is it a mechanism for passing a constitutional amendment against abortion, but it is also a mechanism for opening up the entire Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the whole notion of judicial review and the whole notion of federalism, which is all under attack by the sort of broadly spoken Reaganite.
Yeah, in fact, maybe we should move on to talk a little bit about the Family Protection Act, which is another example of how this defederalization is going to attempt to bring issues that concern the family back to the state level, so that if the state decides that, people did not descend from primates, that they can do that if they wish, although that's been fairly recent in some states. But what this does is to reach into the schools, to affect school children, to affect teachers, and to really seep into every grassroots level of life without any kind of regulatory power or even supervisory power from the federal government. And the bill, this is called the Family Protection Act, which was originally introduced in 1979 by Senator Laxalt. Rhonda, maybe you'd like to just briefly go over the subdivisions of the Act and explain how each of these little pieces fits together in the jigsaw puzzle and will really have a monumentally devastating effect.
Yeah, well, I think that there are basic constituencies attacked by the Family Protection Act: women, minorities, poor people, and gay people. And that what it is an effort, it's an effort to impose the ideology of the moral majority on the nation. It's an effort to impose the economics of the moral majority on the nation, which is take it away from the welfare programs and the poor and give it through tax incentives to the middle class. Eliminate public resources and public functions like schools and provide tax incentives for private schools for the middle class. And let me just give you a few of the just horrendous examples. I mean, they're all quite horrendous. In the area of education, they will withhold federal funding unless states enact laws allowing voluntary prayer in school buildings. One of the things that threads the Family Protection Act is the irony of states' rights philosophy, which is that when you can assert the states' rights ideology in order to fend off federal constitutional protections, or federal efforts against discrimination, then states' rights becomes the ideology. When, however, you think you have enough power at the federal level, you will have the right, doing what they're doing through the Family Protection Act, which is attempting to use the power of the government to impose ideological control on the states. So that's one example. They say that parents have to consent to having their children in courses about religion, and that they can have these courses and parenthood, and that they can have these parenthood read sex education courses taught for credit by ministers outside of the schools. They call for complete parental control over curriculum. They call for ideological control, like you can't have programs which inculcate values which are against the dominant values in the community, or educational materials which tend to denigrate, diminish, or deny the role role differences between the sexes as it has been historically understood in the United States. Well, that's a little vague, but what they really mean to do is to say nothing that teaches feminism, nothing that teaches, you know, role stereotyping as being inherently wrong, should be able to be taught, and that they will withhold funding from any program that does that.
I believe that section also provides for parent vigilantes to come and sit in the classrooms, have the right to come into the classroom at any time. Who knows what Albert Shanker and company might have to say about that in connection with pedagogical problems, but in any event, that it becomes a very different kind of open classroom.
It's very similar to the fundamentalist drive to control the schools that really materialized in the anti-evolution laws, the Scopes laws in the 1920s. You have this same kind of drive to control, and they know where the minds of the young are there. At the same time as they want to have all this control over the public schools, they really want to undermine them. First of all, they want to exempt private, the so-called Christian schools, which want to practice racism, from any kind of federal non-discrimination requirements. There are other policies which provide tax incentives to the middle class, which allow parents to set up parent-run schools, and they will pay for this. It's very explicit in the Family Protection Act. They will pay for this by repealing most of the major titles of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, which is the basis of federal support for funding for schools in urban areas, for funding for minorities, for bilingual education, for all of the educational programs that affect poor and minority people. When they do their anti-food stamp and anti-welfare, they want welfare for the middle class. They want it in a particular way also. Oh, they also want to eliminate the eligibility of college students for food stamps. They also want to do this thing in a very particular way. They want to provide enough tax incentives to the middle class to make it, given that women earn 59 cents in the workforce as compared to a dollar that a man earns,